right, so I'm joined here today by Eric Bindler and Greg Goodwin of Bluefield Research, both of them. So let's just get in this conversation. On March 8th this year, just a couple of days ago, the US EPA issued a memorandum to guide sort of, I guess, collaborative implementation with state, local, tribal authorities for, I guess, $43 billion in water infrastructure funding through the IIJA legislation. And so the memo, really, this is what we're talking about here, guys, is the EPA has put out this memo to provide some guidance about how all of these dollars are going to be channeled into the market. So what I was hoping to do with you guys today is sort of talk through this, any issues and sort of opportunities and also definitions of how this money might roll out to the market. So before we do that, Eric, how are you?
Hey, Reese, how's it going? Got a little bit of a shaky internet connection, but hopefully we'll be able to pull this off. But otherwise, I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. We'll keep that in just so everybody knows that we're humans. Greg, what about you? How's it going?
Going pretty well. Hope the internet holds up as well. I mean, no indications it won't, but doing well on this sunny Friday, so can't complain.
Nice. Well, why don't we, Eric, let's start with you. I mean, both of you guys have been at conferences also. Eric, you were at UMC in Orlando a couple of weeks ago, so you were interfacing with a lot of utilities and vendors there. And Greg, actually, you just got back from Water Reuse Conference in San Antonio. So to the extent you guys can provide some insights on sort of this topic and what people were talking about there, it would be great. So Eric, we'll start with you. What's the background? Give us a little context.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And that, I think that segue from the conferences and from UNC is a nice one, because that's actually, I think, one of the main kind of venues that alerted us to the fact that this memo was coming out, that you know, really a lot of conversation at UMC about what this was going to mean. So just to back up and give a little bit of background here. So as, you know, our listeners most will know, as kind of, you know, industry participants will know, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA, was signed into law back in November of last year. $55 billion total over 5 years earmarked for the water, wastewater, stormwater industry. And about 80% of that is being administered through the SRF, the state revolving fund programs that already kind of exist, that have existed for a couple decades. And so it's a big chunk of money, right? About $11.7 billion each over 5 years for the drinking water SRF and for the clean water SRF. There's also $5 billion for PFAS and emerging contaminants, $15 billion for lead service line remediation. Those are really the big chunks of funding that were allocated or that were earmarked through IIJA. Those are all being administered through the existing SRF program. And so this memo, really what, you know, the point here is that, you know, Congress kind of laid out the details, kind of broad strokes in terms of some of these funding carve outs, some of the changes to the way that they want these SRF programs to be administered. And, if, you know, kind of a bipartisan bill, right? Bipartisan fashion, bipartisan policy priorities. But what we see here now is we've got the EPA, which is, you know, responsible for administering these programs, kind of getting a chance to step in and provide its own guidelines, its own policy priorities in terms of how the SRF program is going to be implemented, how it's going to be administered over the next 5 years, over the kind of the course of the IIJA funding. And so it's a really interesting kind of snapshot of the Biden administration's and kind of Democratic policy priorities when it comes to water infrastructure, right? So there's a big focus in here on environmental justice, on climate change, on labor unions, on civil rights. And so it's, you know, the EPA kind of putting their stamp on how these dollars are going to be allocated moving forward.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've discussed is just definition, right? It sounds like even the definitions of disadvantaged communities is going to vary from state to state. You know, the EPA is really just providing guidelines or guidance to encourage, if that's the right word, the state program managers about how they should prioritize certain projects and what is included and what's not. But this doesn't sound like it's the end of the line, though. I mean, it sounds like, you know, there's still a lot of discussions about exactly how the dollars are going to be prioritize? Do you think just that the dollars, either one of you, if you're willing to jump in, and that is, are we going to see any dollars hit the market this year? Are they already baked into the SRF request so far?
The timeline that they outline is essentially that states have a year with each kind of each annual capitalization of the program. So every year there's a certain amount of funding dispersed. The states have a year to commit that funding, to basically agree to the terms of the loans, decide on the projects and all of that, and then 2 years to spend those dollars. So I think basically this first tranche of funding, the funding that's being kind of allocated to the state, to the individual state revolving funds this year, it has to be spent within the next 2 years, basically. And then each year we'll see another kind of a 2 year deadline. So I don't know how quickly it can go out the door. I mean, I don't think we're really going to see a lot of those dollars actually hitting the market this year, right? Because certainly all of that legwork in terms of, you know, evaluating the programs and picking the project list and kind of agreeing all of the loans, I think it's going to be some time before all that happens. But that's basically the maximum timeline, is that the dollars being, you know, allocated or being kind of used to capitalize those programs this year have to hit the market within 2 years.
Yeah. And I think one, it'll be interesting to see. We look at this every year. Actually, we have someone digging into SRF projects right now, going state by state for clean water and drinking water. And, you know, was it last year we looked at $94 billion of requests, of which I think was it close to $17 billion were actually awarded. And so there's a huge gap between requested and allocated or awarded funding. So I wonder how many of the, I suspect a lot of these projects will either roll over, maybe they'll be sort of redefined in the price. So the queue is already long for these requests. Then the question is on the back end, how will they be prioritized? I mean, you said if they're, you know, buzzwords, if you will, are things like disadvantaged community or water workforce or, you know, lead service lines or PFAS, civil rights. You know, if you're hitting those targets, depending on the state, you know, I suspect there's going to be a wide range of definitions for that. There may be some kind of quick application rollover, sort of rolling awards or rolling applications from one last period to this period. Let's look at or step back a little bit and like, why should the industry care? And maybe who within the water industry should care about this? Greg, you have any thoughts on that?
So just to kind of step back a little bit, as you sort of mentioned earlier, Reese, we were at the Water Reuse Conference in San Antonio earlier this week. And, you know, there is a component of the IIJA that's really focused on water reuse through the Department of Interior's Bureau of Reclamation. One of the keynotes of one of the days was given by Tanya Trujillo, who is the Assistant Secretary for Water and Science under the Department of Interior. And so she was really kind of getting into, you know, how that money is going to be dispersed in the West, hopefully, in sort of large major projects. I think in the time that we were there, there was sort of the unfortunate sort of relevant news that I think it was Lake Powell had hit its all-time sort of low amount in terms of the reservoir holding capacity, which is obviously not a milestone that anybody wants to hear about, but certainly relevant for what was occurring. So really kind of those Western states that use the Colorado River Basin as the main source of water. Another area that got into a little bit more on sort of the technical areas, you know, kind of how to use SRF towards projects like stormwater, which are historically not gotten a good share of those dollars. And there's many reasons for that. Part of it is sort of this multi-layered regulatory atmosphere that needs to be navigated from the federal down to sort of the really local level. And then also just kind of the disparate nature of how stormwater utilities and capture tends to work, where that water goes, how to divert it and so forth. But that was a focus, particularly in the super sort of water strapped states like California and the Southwest that are trying to make use of that water, in part because in some cases, particularly in California, the The conservation efforts have been successful enough that they're having issues in terms of the amount of flow and sanitary pipes, and looking to kind of augment that with diverting stormwater. So that's sort of a forward-looking way of constructing those projects, and maybe a sign of where some of those might go in the future.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so that's sort of, you know, those are certain areas of interest. Stormwater is obviously a huge one. And like we talked a little bit about it, it's really kind of a non-point problem, right? So there are a lot of stakeholders involved. And so whose responsibility is it? Is it citywide? You know, we're talking, you know, that includes the municipal utility, includes Department of Transportation, includes Parks and Rec. There are all these different stakeholders. And so how do you take this federal funding, if you even can, right? I mean, I know their application, or do the requests even meet certain criteria to receive funding through SRF? So that is a kind of a big challenge that I think you've talked a little bit about, at least with me in the past, about, you know, how do we manage the stormwater? And there's no shortage of interest, as we know. But, you know, to Eric, I mean, as far as why, any other thoughts on, you know, why industry players should care about this as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think just as I was reading through this memo, you know, since it came out on Tuesday, I think there are a couple really interesting wrinkles here in terms of efforts to address some of the past challenges with past sources of funding, like past kind of stimulus programs, namely the ARRA during the recession, and also just the way that the SRF has kind of been administered on a year-to-year basis prior to IIJA. I mean, one thing, as I mentioned, the timeline, right? Like there was a lot of criticism in the industry after the ARRA, the American, I think, Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 or so, the kind of, you know, Obama-era response to the Great Recession. You know, basically there was this emphasis on shovel-ready projects, right? That the goal was to get the money out the door as quickly as possible. And so a lot of those projects that maybe already were in the queue from past years of SRF funding were just pulled up and given dollars. There wasn't really a lot of focus on developing thoughtful and transformative infrastructure projects that were really going to make a difference in addressing key areas like water quality or like, you know, affordability or accessibility or that kind of thing. And so the fact that this is kind of a five-year program, I mean, as I said, every state has basically 2 years to spend each tranche of funding, but it is, I mean, it's basically a seven-year funding window if you tack on, you know, those 2 years to the end of the five-year bill. It gives communities and it gives states and EPA more time to kind of help identify and develop these more kind of transformative and impactful projects. So that's one thing that I think is important in terms of why should we care. The other would just be focusing this kind of focus within, you know, I mean, it's in the text of the IIJA itself, but especially in this EPA implementation memo, there's a strong focus on helping communities that haven't traditionally had access to SRF funding get access to that. And that's, it could be small communities, rural communities, disadvantaged communities, communities with kind of affordability challenges. And so there's a big chunk of the funding that's actually earmarked for basically 49% of the core clean water and drinking water SRF funding that's earmarked for disadvantaged communities, for smaller communities, for communities with affordability challenges. And that is kind of, you know, written into the language of the bill, as far as I understand. So that's kind of interesting. And there's also a smaller kind of state matching requirement. Like typically in the past, states have to match 20% of the EPA allocations. In this case, that matching share is down to 10% for the first 2 years. And actually some of those supplemental programs, the emerging contaminants programs, the drinking water or the lead program, there's 0% state match. So really trying to incentivize states to go out and use this, you know, to not leave any money on the table to kind of use the full federal allocation. And then there's a lot of emphasis as well in just on using some of the funding to do outreach with disadvantaged communities, to help with technical assistance, to help communities actually, you know, prepare applications and identify projects and just get more people kind of using these dollars. And so that's something that I think is needed in the industry. I mean, I think as we've talked about the SRF program in the past, a lot of it is on the communities that have the money to hire third-party consultants to help them build these project applications, that have the capacity to hire professional grant writers on their staff. They're the ones who get these dollars, right? So the fact that there is this emphasis on reaching smaller communities, disadvantaged communities, communities that don't have those capabilities, you know, it's a big part of this implementation memo. It's a big part of the bill. It's definitely a major policy priority for the Biden administration.
So I think one of the frustrations about the program, if there is one in particular, is it varies. The program management varies so much state by state. And we'll continue to do so. I mean, that's kind of the role of the EPA. Like I said, provide guidance, but you can't, you know, make it really a more local issue, locally managed issue or opportunity. What's your take or what's your feeling? I know you guys have been at conferences. What's your feeling on sort of, are there regional differences or state differences that kind of showcase markets of opportunity versus other less opportunistic geographies?
Sure. So I can kind of just get into that a little bit. You know, particularly, this is the way that the SRF program has sort of worked since its inception, and the modern program since the late 80s, I guess, if you will. You know, I mean, there's that federal sort of coffer of available dollars and sort of suggestions and how it be used. And then really, it's kind of the states that have their final say in, you know, where those dollars get allocated and how they define certain, you know, criteria. Certainly, you know, as kind of Eric mentioned earlier, you know, the lead service line removal component is a very large sort of line item in how this bill has been passed, and one of the major goals of to, you know, try to get that lead out of the ground in over the next couple decades. And I know we've talked about that pretty extensively kind of at Bluefield. I mean, obviously that's something that is, you know, affects some parts of the country more than others, you know, thinking about the Northeast, the Midwest, sort of Chicagoland area that has that in very high sort of concentration and quantities compared to, you know, some other areas with newer build, and sort of newer developments and so forth. So, I mean, that's definitely one area where that's going to have some large disparities just in terms of what's being prioritized there. Similar with sort of the PFAS type of initiative and emerging contaminants, you know, that's something that is going to affect the whole country at large. But, you know, there are pockets of, you know, regions that have larger issues with PFAS and other contaminants, whether it be Michigan or New Jersey or other, you know, highly industrialized states and places that have, you know, a large either current or decommissioned sort of roster of military installations. So, you know, where we see those dollars get allocated, you know, is going to be sort of regional and point specific to some of those issues, but it's going to even out, I guess, compared to how those things play out.
Right. But to follow up on Eric's point, though, for those who don't know, I'm from the South, right? So I can take it. You can tell me the truth. Eric, general, can you stereotype us? And what about geographically? What's the word on the street? How do people feel about the programs and program management geographically?
Yeah, I mean, this is what's really interesting about all this is that you kind of pick up this memo and you read the first few pages and it's these really, really interesting kind of bold policy areas in terms of, as I said, environmental justice and climate change, you know, both climate adaptation and mitigation, cybersecurity, you know, working with labor unions, civil rights is a line item in there in this implementation memo. And these are kind of the federal EPA priorities around the SRF program. But when you dig into it, at the end of the day, the states still have a lot of leeway in terms of how they actually allocate these dollars and how they administer these programs. And so we've done some research in the past. You know, I think Reese, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, we look into the SRF intended use plans state by state on an annual basis, and we see these really, you know, kind of these pretty significant disparities in how different states actually use this money. And you know, we've got a great exhibit that maybe some of our readers will or listeners will have seen in our reports. That's basically the share of each state's, you know, where each state sits in terms of their share of the total federal dollars allocated versus how much they're actually spending, their share of total dollars spent in this program. And like Ohio, for example, jumps out as really kind of punching above their weight in, I think in past years and maybe still currently, they basically commit to fund every eligible project request that they receive. And they do that by taking the federal dollars that they're getting, but also going to the bond market and kind of augmenting the federal capitalization with other, you know, financing sources. And they fund all the projects that come in. So they're kind of up there as an overachiever in our terminology. And other states are, you know, not doing as well. They're kind of leaving money on the table. They're not going out. Maybe they don't want to meet that full 20% match. And so hopefully the reduced matching requirements will help out this time around. But, you know, I don't know that I've seen, you know, in terms of breaking it up into like broad regions, like, you know, the South versus the Northeast versus the Midwest. The one comment that I thought was interesting was actually at UMC a couple weeks ago, I should say. I was on a panel with Arcadis talking about, you know, utility financing and SRF. And the one comment was that the Southeast really doesn't use the SRF program that as much as there was an previous administrator from New York who was like, you know, we use this for all of our projects. It's really the go-to funding source for water, wastewater infrastructure projects. Not so much the case in the South, and trying to make a case for why it should be used more robustly. So definitely some differences there. And it filters down, I mean, as we were talking about earlier, again, you know, you've got these kind of sweeping federal priorities around disadvantaged communities and affordability, but every state is able to define disadvantaged communities in their own way based on their own kind of formula. And the EPA, I think, is going to have a little bit of oversight of that process, maybe help support that process. But at the end of the day, it's really up to states to decide.
Well, so one thing that's outstanding, guys, that I don't know if there's still not a lot of clarity, as far as I can tell, is Build America, Buy America, or, you know, aspect of the spending and sort of what does that mean? We've had a number of clients asking about this because it could have wide-reaching implications, but also the bigger context is when this was proposed, which was pretty extreme, up to 75%, I think they were talking about needed to be American made of a wider variety of products in July. It was an inflationary environment then. We're in a whole nother level of inflation, it seems, at this point, partly because of Russia and Ukraine, but just things haven't settled down in the supply chain. So, Greg, you've looked at this in a little bit of detail. What's your take?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think to your point there, Reese, there is, you know, this is still something that is not fully in focus and may not be for a few months. So the Buy America, Build America plan is not a new provision overall. I mean, it's something that has existed in some sense since kind of the 1930s in terms of public infrastructure types of products or projects rather. I mean, the real difference or one of the real differences between this latest iteration is that the, you know, some of the building commodities typically has been iron and steel that have been had domestic sourcing requirements. And this version of the IIJA expanded that into things like lumber and other types of materials and so forth. And then also finished goods, you know, as you mentioned before, I believe the current provision is for 55% to be U.S. Created to be able to kind of qualify for some of these federal dollars. There was, you know, debate about raising that level to 75%. There are, you know, potential waivers for that. I mean, if you can demonstrate that it's going to raise the cost of a project by more than 25% overall, or if it's somehow not in the public interest, there are waivers for how that works out. You know, the bill also created a White House office within the OMB to sort of suss out how, you know, these requirements are really going to play out. There was a time period that was attached to that. I think it was basically 6 months after signing where there would be more concrete details of, you know, what was going to be waived, what was going to be, you know, allowed in. And I'm sure that, you know, the Hill is full of lobbyists and others that are trying to make their case for why they should be exempted. So there's going to be obviously a lot of, a lot going on and probably is going on right now and how that actually plays out. I don't think we're going to know exactly how it will play out for probably a couple of months as well. And, you know, to your point there, there are additional cost and sort of supply chain issues that are even being added upon what we were dealing with just a few months ago with sort of the geopolitical world situation. So that might have some effects as well. But generally, you know, this is something that could definitely affect vendors for products and so forth if they, you know, don't meet a specific component requirement and are not able to get a waiver. It could possibly affect, you know, access to certain projects. I mean, it's still kind of nebulous and a little bit cloudy, but, you know, we expect to probably see a little bit more about how this is going to play out maybe, you know, in the coming months. I guess it's just to put it more generally.
Yeah. And there were a couple of hurdles. I think one was, it was a January, February hurdle. And then I think the final sort of determination or implementation is mid-May.
Yeah, the bill was signed in what, mid-November as law. So yeah, in mid-May, I think we expect to see a broad outline coming from the White House of how the different departments are supposed to implement these requirements for domestic sourcing and so forth. So a couple weeks, 2 months, maybe that we see that come into focus more.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out because supply chain is a pretty messy place right now, given all the constraints across the board. Well, Eric, I don't want to overlook this. You know, one thing that seems to be a little bit different in this SRF funding is the role of climate and or digital factors. I mean, any thoughts on that and how that could play out in the awards going forward?
Yeah, definitely. This was something that really stood out to me, especially in comparing this recent SRF implementation memo from 3 days ago to the actual language of the IIJA and some past, you know, just how the program's kind of been administered in the past. So one of the, you know, top line policy priorities for in this document that the EPA has laid out is basically a focus on climate kind of adaptation and resilience, as well as climate mitigation, which is something that I think we've been talking more about, you know, just the contributions of the global water wastewater industry to greenhouse gas emissions, right? You know, we think of utilities often as being, or the water industry as being kind of affected by or kind of a victim of changing climate conditions. But we also have to think about their role in kind of contributing to to emissions. And, you know, in particular, the water industry is responsible for a decent share of global methane emissions, of nitrous oxide, particularly, you know, from wastewater treatment. And then just all the energy kind of carbon emissions associated with pumping and with maintaining, you know, large fleets and all of that. So I think it was really interesting to see that as a kind of a policy priority for the EPA. You know, again, and they kind of explicitly mentioned both of those things, methane, nitrous oxide, but also, you know, renewable energy generation and that kind of thing. The thing that the rub is again, there's not really any teeth that I can see in the EPA laying out those policy priorities versus what states actually choose to do. The one exception to that is that, as I mentioned earlier, 49% of the clean water SRF dollars states are required to use for grants or for principal forgiveness loans, as opposed to just the kind of standard low interest rate, below market rate loans that the SRF administers. Within that 49%, the projects that are eligible for that funding, they can be for disadvantaged communities or for dealing with affordability constraints, but they can also be for water energy efficiency projects, for dealing with stormwater runoff, for dealing with kind of sustainable projects or construction or design. So there is like, there's a little bit of a kind of a specific incentive mechanism there whereby the EPA can actually put some pressure on states to try to fund these types of projects. But beyond that, it's really just, this is what the EPA wants to see happen, and they strongly encourage states to do it. It's really going to be up to the states to decide how much they take that on. And the same kind of goes for digital. There is a couple lines in there about cyber resilience, right? Cybersecurity and resilience to cyber attacks. There are a few other more explicit carve-outs in other parts of the IIJA to deal with that. but there's not really a lot of language beyond EPA, you know, encourages or urges states to think about this. And it really, you know, it's going to depend on what the states choose to do.
Yeah, I think that that's what makes it difficult as a whole, you know, any of the EPA guidelines. I mean, one thing that you did bring up, though, is, you know, as far as teeth, you know, there is at least a mechanism or set of mechanisms that if states do not use the dollars or funding, the EPA does reserve the right, is one way to put it, to shift that to other states that may be using it or may need it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. That 49% additional subsidy, which is basically the principal forgiveness loans or the grants, if states aren't able to come up with projects or communities that fit the bill, that again, either addressing kind of affordability concerns, disadvantaged communities, or potentially some of these water energy efficiency types of priorities, if a state is not coming up with projects to meet that full 49% allocation of their funding, the EPA can take some of that funding and give it to somebody else. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know if that's a new mechanism or not. But it'll be interesting to see whether that actually gets used and in what circumstances as you know, we see this kind of play out over the next few years.
Nice. Well, guys, with that, I really appreciate it. I know I think Greg, you and I talked about IIJA in the fall when it was released, November, early December timeframe, when we recorded the podcast. This provides a little bit more detail on what is happening, or at least how it may roll out. So we'll continue to watch that and hopefully enlighten the world as to what we are seeing and what we think about it. As I always do, Eric, what's your story? What's research-wise, what do you got going on?
Yeah, so what are we doing? We are working on global digital forecasts. Those are really coming into shape nicely. Really excited. We're going to cover about 45 different countries, 30-plus technology segments, really a big expansion of our previous forecasts. We're working on some work on utility innovation and what that means. We're doing a deep dive into the metering market, just kind of key technology and competitive trends that we're seeing in the global metering market. So a lot of really interesting projects underway that I think our clients are going to really be really excited about.
Nice. And Greg, what about you?
So a couple of disparate sort of things, you know, kind of continuing on that water reuse track, seeing what's happening with projects in the West, and particularly what's driving them, how some of those dollars that we just mentioned might be deployed. Also sort of related, but, you know, sort of in a different sphere, sort of the AMI space, how that space is rolling out within states, how granular that data gets, understanding different types of uses for that type of information, and also kind of looking more into sort of that stormwater aspect at the moment. But yeah, it's sort of a smorgasbord right now, as you could say.
Well, that's, you know, that's good. That'll be interesting to see how all of this rolls out. So I know but also I'm certain others are looking forward to getting a perspective and a view on that research. So that being said, let's put a wrap on this and call it a day. So guys, thanks a million for taking the time and admittedly working through the technical difficulties that we had in putting this together. So thanks a million and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Reese.
Thanks.
All right, guys, take care. All right. Well, that was fantastic to catch up with those guys. So before we sign off, please subscribe and give Future Water a review. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, but you can always just subscribe. That in and of itself is a sign that you like what you're hearing. Secondly, send us a note to waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topic ideas you would like us to discuss. We've got a laundry list of them, but what you want is what we want to provide. So shoot us a note. Lastly, tell a friend about it. I'm sure they'd want to hear more about what's happening in the water sector and how complicated it's getting these days. All right. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Be well, be safe, take care. Talk soon.